This is Progressive Radio, a weekly conversation hosted by Matthew Rothschild, editor of The Progressive Magazine, a leading voice for peace and social justice. For more information about Progressive Radio or The Progressive Magazine, log on to our website at progressive.org.
I'm Matt Rothschild, and welcome to Progressive Radio, which you can also grab off our website over at progressive.org. Today, I'm delighted to have in the studio with me Kostas Lapavitsas, a professor of economics at the University of London, one of the keenest critics of the European financial crisis. He has a new book out called Financialization in Crisis, and one on the way called The Eurozone in Crisis, and I'm looking forward to reading both. We were delighted at The Progressive that he wrote an article for us last winter on Greece entitled Turmoil Ahead. He was prescient then, so you might want to listen to him right now. Kostas Lapavitsas, welcome to Progressive Radio.
Hello, it's a great pleasure to be here and an honor to be invited.
Well, I've been reading some of your columns in The Guardian and very much interested in your analysis as to what's going on with this financial crisis and which direction progressives should point to as far as resolving it or at least ameliorating it. But before we get to that, why don't we just examine the root causes of the crisis in Europe?
I think the first thing we should say about the crisis in Europe is that it is a continuation of the crisis that began in the United States in 2007, 2008. This is one crisis that has never really been resolved, never really finished. It's just appeared in this particular form in Europe in 2009, 2010, and in many ways it's the most severe form, because it's threatening to destroy the global financial system in a very decisive way. That's the first thing to say. So it's basically an outcome of tensions and contradictions that have accumulated in the global financial and economic system for a long time. But it has taken a particular form in Europe, and that form is related to the euro as a very peculiar form of currency, new global currency, a currency to compete against the dollar. I think that's how one should think about it, and then it begins to make sense. The euro is a global form of money aimed at providing a means of reserve accumulation and payment across the world for big business and big banks. That's how it's been constructed. It's a form of money that contains within it hierarchical relations among the nations that have put it together. And it's a form of money that has recreated the division between center, core, and periphery in Europe in a very decisive way. And the periphery have borne the brunt of all the contradictions and all the problems of the euro. And that's what we're witnessing now.
And the periphery is Greece, Spain?
The periphery, as all peripheries, are clear in some respects, less clear in other respects. The first thing to say is that the Eurozone has got an internal periphery, which is to which I just referred, and an external periphery. The external periphery I've left out of account. The external periphery is basically Eastern Europe. It's a whole raft of countries which are poor, have gotten few prospects of sustained growth and rising incomes for their people. But let's leave those out of account. The periphery that I've referred to now is the internal periphery, and that's basically Greece, Portugal and Ireland, very clearly so. Spain also is clearly part of the periphery. Mm-hmm. And the country that is in between in many ways is Italy, which is obviously far bigger than the others and far more important in terms of the future of the euro. It's the peripheral countries, then these four peripheral countries that have taken the brunt of the crisis. And this is where we might begin to see fissures developing within mm-hmm. the monetary
and
union.
And the vast majority of the people in those countries who have really felt the pain rather than the owners of banks in those countries, for instance. Is that accurate enough?
There is absolutely no question about it. The burden of the crisis has been imposed on the working people and broader popular layers of peripheral countries, and bankers and others who are well off have generally been protected by the mechanisms of the European Union and through the policies applied onto peripheral countries.
I mean, the bankers are always paid off. They were paid off here. You mentioned the United States. I mean, first George W. Bush and then Obama, you know, in the Fed and the Treasury paid off the banks. The banks here didn't get a haircut at all. They got paid 100% on the dollar. But the United States was able to survive the crisis by papering over it, by and also by going into deficit spending. And in the euro, the construction of the eurozone prohibits that, if I'm correct. Is that why the United States has survived and Europe is still struggling, or is there something else?
I think that's a very important element of it. But one must bear in mind a simple fact about the eurozone compared to the U.S. In the case of the U.S., we've got a federal state, a state that has power across the economic and other jurisdiction of the United States. In Europe, there's no such state. What you have is a collection of states with hierarchy built into them. And therefore, the potential, the ability for following deficit spending, for applying the measures that were adopted in the United States is much more limited in the case of Europe. And let me put it to you differently. A crisis entails losses, costs. Someone must bear these costs and these losses. Typically, in a capitalist crisis, we expect the capitalist class, the capitalists who are basically the class mainly responsible for a crisis, to bear some of these losses and some of these costs. And the struggle is always on the part of the capitalist class to avoid some of these costs and some of these losses. In the case of Europe, the costs and the losses of the crisis have also had the national dimension, not just a class dimension, but the national dimension. Which capitalist class is going to bear these losses? And what has prevailed from the beginning is that it certainly isn't going to be the German capitalist class that is going to take the losses imposed on the system or brought onto the system because of actions of the Greek capitalist class. And that is a very, very important aspect of the monetary union, which doesn't hold in the United States. The United States is a single polity, single class structure dictating terms. So the ability to impose losses and to accept costs and so on is very different in the case of Europe, and that has dictated the policies to confront the crisis.
I'm speaking with Kostas Lapavitsas, professor of economics at the University of London, and in my mind, the keenest critic of the European financial crisis. He writes for The Guardian. You can find his columns there. I highly recommend them. He's got a couple books out. The latest one's Financialization in Crisis and one on the way called Eurozone in Crisis. Why is the German capitalist class not bearing costs? And why has the German government been following a policy that seems to just be so counterproductive for the whole Eurozone and what we know about economics, anti-Keynesian?
You see, let's take that from the start. The Eurozone is a very peculiar system whereby a common monetary policy is imposed on all 17 countries without a common fiscal policy and without a common banking policy. There is no such thing as a European bank. There are 17 types of bank, national types of bank in the Eurozone. That's very, very important. Now, within this system, the dominant role is played by German economic interests. And this means specifically German banking interests, but also German exporting interests. Industrial exports are a very, very important part of the German interests involved in this outfit. Now, the German domestic economy is not doing very well at all. People who think that Germany is this thriving capitalist machine simply not well informed. The banking interest is doing okay. The exporting industrial interest is doing okay, but the rest of the domestic economy is not doing okay. The reason why that is because, of course, the Eurozone again, which means the tendency, the effort to contain wage costs. This is what has made the Eurozone tick. The effort to contain wage costs, unit labor costs, which the German ruling class has basically won. They've kept wages frozen. The German people have borne the brunt of German economic success, such as it has been. And that has meant that the domestic economy has been pretty much in stagnation for years and years, because how can you have vibrant domestic demand when wages are stagnant? But that's what has created German success in the Eurozone. Frozen labor costs, weak domestic demand, a weak domestic economy, but substantial exports and substantial banking success. Now, put that in the context of the Eurozone and you will see what it means, because the bulk of the exporting success is within the Eurozone, as far as Germany
is concerned. It's not to the United States.
It's not to the United States. There is more success in Asia recently, but still, the core, the backbone, is the Eurozone. Effectively, the Eurozone has become a domestic German exporting, trading area.
So the market for German goods is other European countries in the Eurozone.
The bulk of German surpluses, trade surpluses, come from the Eurozone, overwhelmingly so. They come from the European Union, and more specifically from the Eurozone. Now, put two and two make four, because if that's what happens and that's how Germany succeeds, then the rest of the Eurozone countries cannot succeed. Someone has to lose, and the main losers have been peripheral countries. Just as unit labor costs have been frozen in Germany and provided for German competitive success, they have not been frozen in peripheral countries, and they've made for competitive losses in peripheral countries. And you have this combination of successful Germany, less successful periphery. Or to put it to you differently, Germany has created a system whereby it impoverishes its own domestic workers, it keeps them on a leash, and bankrupts everybody else within the Eurozone. This is a system that cannot sustain itself, in my view.
And it's why Germany is very unpopular in places, especially in the periphery, that are hurting so badly.
That is definitely the case, but that is also why the Eurozone is unpopular among German workers. And that is something people often misunderstand or ignore. German workers have not really benefited tremendously from the Eurozone. They've seen their wages being frozen. They've seen their conditions being stagnant for a long period of time. And naturally, and quite logically, they balk at the notion of making sacrifices. Further sacrifices for the Eurozone. You know, why should they make further sacrifices? I fully understand all that. Although, of course, the ideology that is attached to that in Germany can often be poisonous. You know, lazy Southerners, feckless Portuguese, and lazy Greeks, and all this.
And those kinds of attitudes are commonly adopted here in the United States. When people are talking, especially the Republicans, talking about the crisis in Europe, they say, "Oh, you know, the Greeks—they're slothful, or they were had these ridiculously generous pension benefits. You could retire at 55 and go to the beach and play backgammon all day long," which sounds like fun. What is wrong with that depiction?
What is right with this depiction? Greece is basically a middle-income country that contains substantial layers of poverty. That's the reality of it. Greeks work far longer hours than Germans, and than many other people in the core of the Eurozone. They might not work as productively, perhaps, or as efficiently, perhaps, but nonetheless, they work far longer hours than most other people in the Eurozone. The Greek state has got lower social provision than most other Eurozone states. Greece is a very unequal place. Income distribution is particularly problematic. Social provision as far as health, education, transport and so on is not particularly dynamic and not particularly successful. So all that stuff about Greeks, you know, living off the fat of the land and taking advantage of hardworking northerners while they decamp to the beach and so on. These are just basically racist stereotypes. And if I may say something else on this, because it's interesting. I mean, the last 2 years, the war of words between Greece and Germany in the popular press has been virulent. And many people have interpreted this as a reemergence of ancient enmities, Second World War and so on. Well, I beg to differ. I think that these are new enmities. These are new types of racism, new types of hostility, which are created, have been created by the Eurozone, by the European Union, such as it is. These are not old hostilities that somehow have escaped the unifying and pacifying outlook of the European Union, you know, the commonality of the European peoples and the harmony that's been created by the new institutions, and somehow they have failed to take account of these little problems. That's not the case at all. In fact, these are distinctions and divisions and enmities created by the European Union and by the Monetary Union because of what it is, because it is an exploitative and because it's a hierarchical set of mechanisms.
So are you concerned about a rise of a new right in Europe?
Very much so, very much so. And that again, is a reflection of these enmities, hostilities and problems that the institutions of the European Union and of the Monetary Union have created. People misunderstand the European Union, and particularly the monetary union, they think it's this highly democratic, egalitarian set of mechanisms emanating from Brussels. Nothing could be farther from the truth. In many important respects, these are mechanisms that elitists cut off from the popular vote and popular will, self-sustaining and imposing themselves on people. And that is actually understood in an instinctive sense by broad layers of working people across Europe. And if there is no progressive alternative presented to people, then they will go for alternatives that are problematic and unpalatable. So the rise of the right, given what has been happening in Europe the last few years, is not that problematic. People wish to find a radical alternative, something that will call a spade, you know, and call the problems of the European Union for what they are. And if the right do so, and if the right speak a forceful and radical language, then, yeah, people will listen to it. And if problems arise, then you shouldn't blame people for those problems. You should blame the system that creates them, and you should blame the political parties that fail to take it in a progressive direction.
I'm speaking with Kostas Lapavitsas, professor of economics at the University of London, a very perceptive critic of the analyst of the European financial crisis, critic of the Eurozone. What are some of the progressive alternatives then that would compete with the rightist alternatives that we saw in France with Le Pen, for instance?
Well, to be honest, the rot has progressed so far, has gone so far in the Eurozone, in the European Union, that it's hard to see, aggregate policies that might bring better solutions without a radical break. It seems to me that the situation has become so problematic that for anything positive to come out of the current situation in Europe, we need basically major social confrontation, major social change. The tectonic plates must shift. I mean, this is basically what's happening. If they don't shift, then things are not going to get better. So that's the first thing to say. And anybody who thinks that with a little bit of tweaking of institutions, with some change of policy in Brussels, with a change of government, because elections might bring a slightly different configuration of politicians in power in Germany or elsewhere, or France, things are going to change, they are misled. I think that radical change is necessary. Now, in the periphery, this is obvious, it seems to me. In Greece and increasingly in Portugal, it is increasingly obvious that only radical change, only radical shifts will bring a better future. And to be frank, the peripheral countries of Europe must seriously consider the option of defaulting on their national debt in a sovereign and democratic way, and exiting from the monetary union, recapturing command over monetary and fiscal policy, and beginning to transform their economies in a direction that is in the interests of the majority of working people. I think this is how the issue poses itself in the periphery. Radical change with that would bring significant social transformation. In the core, I'm prepared to recognize that things look different. Naturally, things would not look the same in Germany as they would look in Greece. The problems of German workers and German working people generally are not the same as those of Greek working people, for instance. But even there, radical change is, again, necessary. The power of banks must be restrained. Is paramount. The power of big business, big exporting business, must be restrained. Germany needs to rebalance its economy. It needs to restrengthen domestic demand. It needs to make sure that the income of its people rises systematically, and it needs to make sure that the German people obtain the fruits of their labor more fully than they've done so far. None of these things will happen without significant social and political struggles in Germany, I'm afraid, and the same for other core countries of the European Union.
I'm speaking with Kostas Lapavitsas, who's from the University of London and has been writing about and studying this European financial crisis now ever since it started, and actually the U.S. financial crisis, which precipitated it in large part. So let's talk about Greece in particular for a second. You had a headline on a column you wrote in The Guardian called Greece is Heading for Hell, which caught my attention. And you said in there that, and I didn't actually know this, that it's the deepest depression ever that the Greek people have been suffering. Describe the consequences of the austerity for the mass of people in Greece.
What has prevailed in Greece are conditions that look like war, without a war having been declared, basically. The Greek economy, by the end of this year, will have contracted by 20% on a cumulative basis. And the contraction will continue next year, most probably. Unemployment in the aggregate will be above 20% by the end of this year. And among the youth, it will be more than 50% in all probability. The implications of this hardly need spelling out. Basically, the large urban centers of Greece are facing a humanitarian crisis at this stage. There are problems with health provision. There are problems with food provision. There are people who increasingly rely on NGOs for access to medical supplies and for access to food supplies. And medical supplies, incidentally, are more difficult to secure than food supplies because, you know, food you can improvise with, medicine you can hardly improvise with. Schools have got major problems. The transport system is being disrupted. It's a disaster. The only way to describe it is a disaster, particularly for the youth who see no future at all in the country. And they're right not to see any future because there is no future as long as these policies continue. Because even after the contraction stops, you know, economies do not contract forever. The contraction will stop at some point. Even after that, there is no prospect of rapid growth, no prospect of significant growth that will reverse the disaster. The prospect is for insignificant, indifferent growth as far as the eye can see. And all that will be taking place under the burden of a vast debt which is accumulated in large part because of membership of the Eurozone and the attendant expansion of the financial system. So that's the prospect for Greece, national, economic, and social decline crushed by public debt and private debt increasingly, because interestingly enough, even private debt has now become a problem. Until 2 years ago, private debt, which had grown substantially, was not a major problem in Greece. People could handle it. But with the policies applied to the country, with the contraction of the economy, previously manageable debts, private debts, have now become unmanageable. So this is the state of the country, and it's clear to me that radical change is needed, radical direction, redirection of economic policy is needed if Greece is to get out of this trap.
We have only 5 minutes left, unfortunately, Kostas Lapavitsis. Kostas Lapavitsis is my guest. He's a professor of economics at the University of London. I'm Matt Rothschild. I'm the editor at The Progressive. You're listening to Progressive Radio. What I want to talk about is the larger issue of what I perceive as the demise of social democracy in Europe. I'm sitting here in Madison, Wisconsin, and I've been looking for 3 decades now at social democracies in Europe as an alternative to the kind of primitive capitalism, increasingly primitive, actually, here in the United States. And now you look over in Europe and the social democracies that have been presiding over the Eurozone, especially, you know, there have been French socialist governments, not Sarkozy, but others, and in Greece, Papandreou, of all people, and yet they imposed the hardship. And so it takes away one alternative that we've been posing or presenting as a desirable one, and it's been discrediting. And so why has social democracy failed, and what is to replace it?
In a sense, this is the deepest and most complex political problem of our time, of our age, I think. See, the problems in Europe and the problems in the United States, I think, to a large extent, in the coming years will be problems of debts, problems of inequality, problems of lack of growth. And when we look at who might be dealing with these problems and from which political perspective, we've got to recognize the social democracy in the traditional form that we have known it for decades simply doesn't cut it any longer. And the import of the Eurozone crisis is that he has brought this, it's made this very clear for all to see. There was this myth for a long time that Europe presents an alternative, that it represents soft power, it represents welfareism, an approach to capitalism which is very different from Anglo-Saxon capitalism bred in tooth and claw.
Capitalism with a human face.
Capitalism with a human face. Well, it's now become very clear that all this was a facade. None of this was true. At the heart of the Eurozone is neoliberalism, which is actually harsher and less compromising than the neoliberalism that we know in the United States or even in Great Britain. It's a neoliberalism that sustains and is sustained by the attempt to create the common currency. The Eurozone is inherently a conservative neoliberal creation, an outfit of this type.
So why did social democrats marry neoliberalism?
Because social democracy, when the great struggles of the 1980s came to an end and basically the capitalist class won the day in the United States, Britain, and elsewhere, and when the so-called existing socialism of the Eastern Bloc collapsed, social democracy really believed that the game was up. They really thought that there is no other alternative to market capitalism. All the ideas of controlling markets, negating markets, eliminating markets, and finding a different way of organizing economic life were basically nonsense. They accepted all this.
And so they threw in with the capitalists.
And basically they threw out the baby with the bathwater. Mm-hmm. Or like all proselytes, like all people who go to a new religion or to discover a new belief, they became more royal than the king, as it were. They really believed in this neoliberal nonsense. They really accepted it, and they embodied it. They put it into practice. And when all the contradictions of neoliberalism came to the fore in the last few years, they didn't know what to say. They had great opportunities to do things about it, but they forfeited them.
And so what is the new alternative to market capitalism? How do we arrive there?
Well, it's interesting to see a number of things happening in Europe as the realization of the failure of social democracy has become widespread. What we see is that, first, people can hardly live with the conditions created by neoliberal austerity. They are forced to seek new ways out. And the second thing we see is that as they do that, they look for new ideas. And there is a kind of rebirth of more aggressive, more confident, and in some ways, more old-fashioned, you know, it was more genuine social democracy. We see that in France, where Mélenchon, you know, did pretty well in the election, not as well as he thought and others thought he might do, but nonetheless he did very well. We see that in Germany, where Oscar Lafontaine, and who is probably really the last serious social democrat in Europe, is gaining an influence on the left, and we see that in the United Kingdom, where there's a big internal debate within the Labour Party, and there's some serious efforts to re-establish proper social democracy that aims to control the capitalist economy and aims to control markets. I think these are very promising developments. None of this will lead to anything very much if the social democrats and the left more generally are not prepared to contemplate conflict, not prepared to contemplate serious struggle. None of this will happen without struggle.
So we're going to have to leave it at that. We do need to contemplate those things, and it'll be interesting to see if these alternatives surface in a powerful way. My guest today has been Kostas Lapavitsas. Thanks so much. It's been fun to talk to you.
Thank you very much. It's been a pleasure.
Today's program is available online at progressive.org. You can also write to us at 409 East Main Street, Madison, Wisconsin, 53703. Our music is by Mufa. Progressive Radio is produced by Elizabeth DiNovella and engineered at Audio for the Arts in Madison, Wisconsin.